We'll call the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance meeting to order. We'll start with the roll call.
Johnson.
Here.
Lomer.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Becker Finn. Considine. Dean. Frankie. Here. Grossel.
Here.
Howe. Lucero. Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
O'Neill.
Here.
Pinto.
Here.
Uglum.
Yeah.
Ward. Zerwas.
Hey, this morning we're going to do a walkthrough of the DE amendment. Oh, I haven't. Representative Neuberger, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After deep study and careful examination, I find them in order. I will move them.
There it is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is prevailed. The minutes are approved. Now we will do a walkthrough of the DE amendment. And if, I'm not sure which one of the... Mr. Walsh, will you begin?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to walk through the one-page, two-sided, one-page spreadsheet that is in members' packets, which is essentially a picture of Article 1 of the bill, and the riders in the bill should match the spreadsheet. So, Mr. Chair, beginning on the top of the first page under Supreme Court, the House has included House File 2906 with incorrectly spelled stays of adjudication, sex offenders to register. There's a $182,000 systems maintenance cost for the courts, and that is in fiscal 2018. Moving down to the district courts on line 12, amendment includes House File 3726, ignition interlock. The second year, there's a $618,000 cost in 2019 and included tails. This is for one judge unit and two support clerks. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 20, the guardian ad litem. The amendment includes the guardian ad litem's request for compliance with mandates of 45 FTEs. The governor's position was $3,667,000 in fiscal 19 and $4 million in tails. The House has the original request for 2019 of $3.667 million, but flatlines the tails. This will be a little bit short of the request in fiscal 2020 and 2021. Moving down to the Board of Public Defense, there were three bills included that were fiscal noted by the Board of Public Defense that would include or require additional staffing, and those include House File 2932, the negligent driving with cell phones. That is an $85,000 cost in 2019, entails of $102,000 per year. On line 32, House File 2906, stays of adjudication, sex offenders to register, is $76,000 in 2019 and $153,000 annually entails. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 33, House File 2944, sex offenders 25-year supervision, would require $689,000 for additional staffing in 2019 and $2.7 million each year thereafter. Mr. Chair, moving down to the Department of Public Safety, there were three bills that were included that have a cost at the Department of Public Safety. On line 42, House File 3296, the Vulnerable Adults Working Group receives $39,000 in fiscal year 2019. On line 43, House File 3375, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force, receives $79,000 in fiscal year 2019 and $70,000 in fiscal year 2020 and is sunsetted in 2021. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 46, House File 3726, Ignition Interlock, has a $135,000 cost in 2019, $125,000 thereafter in tails. This is funding from the Driver Services Fund and not the General Fund. Mr. Chair, moving then to the next page, the Department of Corrections, there are several bills. Many of those costs are in the tails. On line 61, the House File 2856 prior offense for DWI from another state would be $14,000 in 2020 and $36,000 in 2021 is the bed impact of the increased penalties. On line 62, House File 2932, negligent driving with a cell phone. Again, that one is a small bed impact beginning in 2020 of $14,000 in 2020 and $36,000 in 2021. On line 63, House File 3505, again misspelled, enhanced theft penalty is $14,000 in 2020 and $36,000 in 2021. On line 64, House File 3610, enhanced penalty for assaulting police is $28,000 in 2020 and $58,000 in 2021 for the bed impact. Line 65, House File 2409, modify sex offender grid for child pornography offenses. Bed impact in the tails in fiscal year 2020, $180,000. In 2021, $608,000. On line 66, House File 2906, stays of adjudication for sex cases to register is in fiscal year 2020, $14,000. In 2021, $43,000. On line 67, House File 2944, sex offender 25-year supervision at the Department of Corrections for their probation officers, $500,000 in 2019, $1 million in 2020, and $1.755 million in 2021. Mr. Chair, on line 68, the same bill, the 25-year supervision, the for local share, and this would go to CCA counties, is $1 million in 2019, $1.4 million in 2020, and $2.6 million in 2021. Mr. Chair, on line 69, House File 3260, criminal sexual conduct, persons of authority, there's a small bed impact in the tails, $14,000 in 2020, and $22,000 in 2021. Mr. Chair, on line 70, House File 3371, criminal sexual conduct by police for persons in custody, and there is a bed impact of $14,000 in 2020 and $36,000 in 2021. On line 71, House File 3465, criminal sexual conduct, eliminating the relationship defense, a bed impact in 2020 of $28,000 and $72,000 in 2021. Mr. Chair, on line 72, House File 4140 is an escalation of the penalty for repeat patrons of prostitution. Bed impact in 2020 of $14,000 and $22,000 in 2021. For a total of $36,000 for the tails biennium. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 79 under the Department of Human Services, House File 1719 had a small cost of $12,000 to the Department of Human Services to update a non-paternity instructional video. And Mr. Chair, on line 88, the House included a bill to increase the dedication to the Special Revenue Fund that funds the Post Board. There's $172,000 impact to the General Fund in 2019, $199,000 in 2020, and $192,000 in 2021. Mr. Chair, on the bottom line, You will see that that meets the tail or the meets the target of $7,119,000 in fiscal 18 and 19 as per the budget resolution. And, Mr. Chair, I'll answer any questions.
Any questions from members on the spreadsheet?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just get some clarification on the ongoing funding for the public defenders. So on the Board of Public Defense, actually in the bill, it on line 2.16, it adds $850,000 in additional staffing, and then it says that the base appropriation shall be $2,966,000 beginning fiscal year 2020. So is that fully funding the tails of this proposal?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, it is fully funding the tails of the fiscal notes that were prepared by the Board of Public Defense. I believe in House File 2944, there may have been some additional needs identified by the public defender for cases involving some of those sexual offenses that could occur beyond 2021. However, it is not common practice that we practice that we budget beyond the tails years, and if there were additional needs, they would have to come back in the future and request additional funding.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to walk through Article 2. Article 2 has provisions that relate to the courts. Sections 1, 2, 3, and 4 of Article 2 are all from House File 1719. That's Representative Whelan's bill related to non-paternity action statute of limitations. Sections 5 and 6 of the bill are from House File 3984. That's Representative Crescia's bill modifying the appointment of counsel in juvenile court. Section 7 is from House File 3958. That's Representative Hoppe's bill related to renewal of judgment on consumer credit transactions. Section 8 is another piece from House File 1719, again, Representative Whelan's bill related to non-paternity action statute of limitations. Section 9 is from House File 1281. That's Representative Zerwas's bill related to prejudgment interest on verdicts, awards, and judgments. The language in Section 9 is identical to the language that appeared in the 2017 Omnibus Bill, which limited the application to prejudgment interest only from the version of the bill that is publicly available right now. Sections 10 through 13 are all from House File 3677. These are provisions from Representative Lesch's bill related to the compensation for exonerated persons. Section 14 is House File 2855. That's Chair Johnson's bill limiting the amelioration doctrine. Sections 15, 16, 17, and 18 are additional provisions from House File 3677. Again, Representative Lesch's bill related to compensation for exonerated persons. Sections 19 and 20 are from House File 2309. That is Representative Lesch's bill related to tracking warrant clarification. Section 21 is the last section in Article 2. That is House File 3436. That's Representative Knobloch's bill prohibiting the use of audio and video coverage in criminal proceedings. This bill has had a slight modification from the version presented. The version presented in committee allowed multiple individuals, including judges and attorneys, to object to the video or audio recording of a criminal proceeding. That has been limited to only the defendant and the victims. That's the end of Article 2. I'm going to move on and summarize Article 3 now. Article 3 contains provisions that relate to public safety and corrections. Sections 1 and 2 are from House File 2857. That's Chair Johnson's bill related to blue lights on tow trucks. It has undergone a very slight change that clarifies that tow trucks can use a red light, blue light, or both while they are stopped. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6 are all from House File 3356. That's Representative Zerwas's bill related to the Public Safety Commissioner's authority to suspend driver's licenses. Section 7 and 8 are parts of House File 2934. That's Representative Grossel's bill related to stays of adjudication records being transferred to the BCA. Section 9 is House File 3554. That's Representative Hillstrom's bill related to the amount charged to counties for the cost of juvenile corrections. Section 10 is House File 3375. That's Representative Kunish Podine's bill creating a task force for missing and murdered indigenous women. This bill has been modified slightly. It now includes four legislators on the task force, and it is now scheduled to sunset after 2 years. Section 11 is House File 3504. That's Representative Zerwas's bill related to gang data. Sections 12 and 13 are additional pieces of House File 2934, Representative Grossel's bill related to stays of adjudication records being transferred to the BCA. Section 14 is House File 3959. That's Chair Johnson's bill related to the disbursement of surcharges on criminal and traffic offenders, increasing the amount that is sent to the post board. Section 15 is an additional piece from Representative Grossel's House File 2934, again related to stays of adjudication records. Section 16 is House File 3611, Representative Grossel's bill related to the prohibition on local officials disarming peace officers. Section 17 is another piece from Representative Grossel's House File 2934 related to stays of adjudication records. Section 18 is House File 3296. That's Representative Keel's bill related to crimes against vulnerable adults, creating a working group. Again, this bill has been changed slightly. It's been amended to include four legislators on that working group. Section 19 is a piece of Representative Zerwas's House File 3356 related to the Public Safety Commissioner's authority to suspend driver's licenses. This is the retroactive portion, and it has been changed slightly by amending the effective date. This was at the request of DVS. It is now effective April 1, 2019. And with that change, there was a notification requirement in the original bill that required DVS to send out letters by December 1, 2018. That date has been moved to May 1, 2019. Finally, Section 20 is a repealer. That's House File 3554, Representative Hillstrom's bill related to the amount charged to counties for the cost of juvenile corrections. That's the end of Article 3, and Chair Johnson, I'd ask you to recognize my colleague Jeff Diebel for Articles 4 and 5.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll walk through Articles 4, 5, and 6. Beginning with Article 4, the general crime article. Sections 1 through 6 of that article come from Representative Frankie's House File 2932, which relates to criminal vehicular operation while driving a cell phone, or while driving with using a cell phone. We jump to page 42 of the delete all for Section 7, which is Chair Johnson's House File 3610, and this modifies the fourth degree assault statute to increase the penalty for assaulting a peace officer to a felony. Section 8 contains language from Representative Grassl's House File 1481, and this enhances penalties for assaulting medical personnel while they're performing their duties. Section 9 through 11 come from Representative Ward's House File 4140, and this concerns prostitution offenses and the penalties and sanctions that go along with those. Moving to Section 12 of Article 4, this is Representative Sarah Anderson's House File 3503, and this enhances penalties for repeat theft offenses. Sections 13 and 14 come from Representative Zerwas's House File 390 and relate to obstructing traffic. Mr. Chair, that concludes the summary of Article 4. I'll move to Article 5, which is entitled Sex Offenders and begins on page 48. For this article, I'll be jumping back and forth between several bills as they modify the same statutes. Section 1 comes from Representative Grassl's House File 2906, and it requires that a judge who issues a stay of adjudication in a felony sex offense case must put the justification for the approval of the stay on the record. It also requires the court to make records of stays of adjudication in criminal sexual conduct cases available via remote access through the Internet. Section 2 contains pieces from two separate bills. It relates to the definition of position of authority. The definition is modified and extended to include current and recent positions of authority, as well as the cases where the person assumes the responsibility. And those provisions are from Representative Lohmer's House File 3260. There's also a piece of Representative Christensen's House File 3203 in this section, which relates to the position of authority offense for secondary school employees and contractors and volunteers. Moving to Sections 3 and 4, these pieces also are from Representative Christensen's House File 3203 and relate to definitions that are used in the third and fourth degree criminal sexual conduct statutes. Section 5 is a piece from Representative Lohmer's 3260 on position of authority and updates the reference to position of authority to reflect the changes made in Section 2. Section 6 is from Representative Grassl's 2944, and it provides notice to offenders of first-degree criminal sexual conduct that they are subject to extended probation, intensive probation, as well as conditional release. Section 7 is another section from Representative Lohmer's House File 3260 related to the position of authority, again updating the reference to reflect the change in the definition. Section 8 is from Representative Grassl's House File 2944 related to extended probation, intensive probation, and extended conditional release. Section 9 contains pieces from three separate bills and relate to third-degree criminal sexual conduct. Again, there's a piece from Representative Lohmer's House File 3260, updating the reference for position of authority. There's also a section from Representative Christensen's secondary school employee criminal sexual conduct bill, House File 3203. And finally, it contains a piece of Representative Fenton's House File 3371, which relates to the prohibition on peace officers having sexual relations with persons in their custody. Moving to Section 10, relating to the penalty for criminal sexual conduct in the third degree, this is from Representative Grassl's bill and provides notice to offenders of their obligation and sanctions related to extended probation and intensive probation. Section 11 is the contains, again, provisions from three separate bills and mirrors Section 9. Has a position of authority update from Representative Lomer's 3260. It establishes the includes a piece from Representative Christensen's House File 3203 related to secondary school employees and contractors and volunteers having relationships with the students, and also contains a piece from Representative Fenton's Police Officer Criminal Sexual Conduct Bill, House File 3371. Section 12 is another piece from Representative Grossel's 2944 related to intensive probation and extended probation. Section 13 is Representative Barr's House File 2800, which removes a piece of the sexual contact definition that is used in fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct so that it is no longer an exception to that crime to intentionally touch another person's buttocks over their clothing with sexual intent. Section 14 is from House File 2904, which is Representative Grossel's bill, and again provides notice to offenders of criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree that they are subject to conditional release, extended probation, and intensive probation. Sections 15 through 18 are from Representative Grossel's House File 2944, which relate to the 25-year conditional release term imposed on offenders who commit felony-level criminal sexual conduct offenses, as well as intensive probation and extended probation. Moving to sections 19 through 28, these are from Representative Grossel's House File 2904, which relate to his child pornography penalty enhancements and mandatory minimum sentences. So again, that bill covers from sections 19 through 28 of Article 5. The final section in Article 5 is a repealer, and that comes from Representative Hortman's House File 3465, and this is the repeal of the marital rape exception. That concludes my summary of Article 5. Pending any questions, I'll move to Article 6, which is entitled Predatory Offenders. This article is comprised predominantly of the BCA's agency bill on the Predatory Offender Registry, House File 3578, with one exception. In Section 3, there is a piece from Representative Grossel's House File 2906, and that piece requires persons who are issued a stay of adjudication for a criminal sexual conduct offense to register as a predatory offender based on that resolution of their case. Otherwise, the entire article is from House File 3578, which was brought to the legislature by the BCA and was passed without amendment. With one amendment from the Department of Corrections related to clarifying the ability for a predatory offender to travel internationally and their duty to receive approval from their corrections agent prior to traveling outside the country. Mr. Chair, I'd ask that you recognize my colleague, Mr. Johnson, to summarize Article 7.
Mr. Johnson. Mr. Chair, members, Article 7 contains provisions related to driving while intoxicated. Section 1 is Chair Johnson's House File 2856. This is the bill that deals with the prior offense in another state being included to support a first-degree charge in Minnesota. The remaining sections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, are all from Representative O'Neill's House File 3726, Those provisions all related to ignition interlock for repeat offenders. There was one slight technical change in that in these provisions that you did not see previously, and that simply added some clarifying language related to Chapter 171. That does not have any actual effect other than clarifying that the provisions of this bill apply to violations of the driver's license requirements in Chapters 169A52, 169A54, and the new Chapter 171.177. That concludes the summary of Article 7 and the full bill walkthrough. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could get some clarification either from the author or from staff. On page 61, line 61.27, in terms of conditional release, fifth degree crimsex, the felony level, is added under the terms of conditional release. However, it's not referenced in the mandatory 25-year conditional release term on line 60.11 is where that starts. My question is it the author's intention to not have it be there, or was it cross-referencing oversight, or is it the intent that conditional release shall apply but not extending it to 25 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it would be the intent to have that on there as well.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the it is your intention that the cross-references should be added then to the 25-year conditional release, and that fifth degree criminal sexual conduct at the felony level would be subject to 25 years of conditional release.
Yes.
Any other questions from the members? Representative Cornish.
Or Constantine.
Not here anymore. It's been a long couple of weeks.
Mr. Chair, I had a very small wording change that would allow us to prosecute people that were intentionally trying to have infectious disease passed to custody officers and police. I'm not seeing that in the bill.
That's on the general register is direct sent to the floor.
And we're going to see that on the floor?
I am hoping we do. I have no control over that part of it.
Boy, I would have liked to have seen it in the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwa.
The majority leader's office handles calendaring of bills. If you made a request for your bill to be calendared?
No, I was expecting it to be in the omnibus bill.
After it got past the general register.
I must have misunderstood the chair. That was the day they started yelling right in my ear when I was up front, so I probably didn't even hear what he said.
Any other questions from members? Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we could just get some clarification on the record, just so the public knows before any testimony about when amendments are due and when you intend to vote on this bill.
Amendments are due at 3 o'clock today. We will be going, we'll have some testimony from the people who have signed up today, and then tomorrow we'll mark up the bill. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so it is your intention that all public testimony should be taken today and that there won't be public testimony tomorrow when we're doing amendments?
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll start with
Mr. Chair, can I, just a quick question?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So was the, when was the bill posted, if I may ask? When would it have been made available to the public?
It was posted around 1 o'clock yesterday.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will start with Commissioner Roy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. Mr. Chair, we've been advised that there are some time constraints on our testimony.
We have some leeway. We have till have some time. We got through this a little quicker than we expected, but we do have a number of people that do wish to testify.
Right. I will be efficient in the use of your time. I have staff in the room that are available for questions with can provide more specificity. I am here to address the three governor's recommendations for our budget, and in your line item spreadsheet, those would be lines 58, 59, and 60. Line 58 specifically is for offender health care. The governor is recommending $7.8 million. There is no funding indicated from this committee, which, of course, is a concern to us. If you recall last year, it was very pointed out very obviously that only 1 year of our health care contract was going to be funded because we were in the midst of an RFP and contract negotiations. I'm pleased to tell you that those negotiations are done. We have were able to secure a five-year contract, and the $7.8 million that the governor is asking for and that we are asking for is to accommodate the new contract for fiscal year 19. As you folks know, we are constitutionally required to provide health care to our offenders. It is a very expensive proposition to do that. We have an annual expenditure of about $94 million, and that expenditure includes psychological services, chemical dependency treatment, our nursing staff, sex offender treatment, which should be of interest to this committee, and all of that under the umbrella of behavioral health. Moving on to line 59, the governor is recommending $710,000 for the opioid initiative. That is a small portion of the governor's proposal of $13 million or so. We hope to include and provide services, transitional services, for people with opioid addictions leaving our prisons, and that will be not only in the terms of providing a higher level of transitional services provided by medical release planners, but also to fund medically assisted treatment, which is the a national initiative, and that is to provide medicine before our offenders are released, so that their cravings are reduced upon release. Our offenders have a high risk of overdosing upon release because they often reengage in use of opioids at the same level that they were using before they went in, and their tolerance level is greatly reduced. And if, in fact, they use at that high level, they often die. So we are, I believe, the smallest part of the opioid initiative, but very important work for us. And moving on to line 60 of the spreadsheet, our population per diem. As you folks know, and I have talked to you numerous times over the years about projecting prison population, that it's not an exact science. And we have found that our projections that we initially started working on in 2016 and established basically 3 years ago for 2019 are showing that we have underestimated prison population, and the request for 7.864 is to accommodate the added beds, and not only for prison beds but for those county beds as well. I should, along with that, give you folks some good news. We are in a small trend downward in terms of the amount of county beds that we are currently renting. I think at one time I presented to this committee that our county bed rental was in the 500 range, and I'm glad to report that this week we are renting 120 beds. That is always risky to tell you folks that. And the reason it is a bit risky is because those trend lines can change very dramatically, very quickly. Yesterday, I heard testimony in the Senate from some folks behind me from Department of Public Safety, a growth in drug-related arrests and seizures, and a 10-year, I believe it was over 500% increase in 10 years. So the drug crisis is with us, and unfortunately, lots of those cases turn into prison sentences, and it's very possible that our initiatives to reduce prison population will be affected by those increases in prison sentences. You folks have heard that the governor is not interested in addressing specific policies, and my discussion this morning will only relate to the three items that I have just talked about. So I stand ready for questions regarding those, and there are details that are available if you need further specificity.
Representative Loma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Roy, for being here this morning. So we've talked about this a little bit a week ago or so, but I have some concerns in my district. I have two prisons, Oak Park Heights and Stillwater, and in the last couple weeks we've had some incidences there where prison guards were injured and went to the hospital and so on. And so I guess my question is, And maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there were some changes to the segregation policies last year to 90 days. And this seems to be maybe one of the reasons for the increases. And just wondering if there will be any changes back to maybe some more disincentivizing for people to be getting into any kind of confrontations with the guards. And my big concern is most of these folks live in my district. These guards have a very dangerous and difficult job, and I just want to know how we can protect them and how we can make them do their job in the safest way possible. We all know it's a very dangerous job anyway, but I'm just really concerned about that. So if maybe you could address that for me. Thank you.
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we share that concern every day. Safety is our highest priority in our prison system. The correction I would immediately make to your comments are that the 90-day, it's been described as a 90-day cap, on assaults on staff, and that is an inaccurate assessment and description of the process. The 90-day is a minimum, and at the 90-day mark, we start a step-down process that is very detailed, and I can provide the committee and others with a description of that step-down process, but that step-down process can be up to a year or longer if, in fact, there isn't good compliance with the steps. We have built in incentives for good behavior, and the recognition nationally for supporting a step-down process is that we know we can't keep people in segregated population forever. We know that those people will be coming back into general population or being released into the community. So it's extremely important that we incentivize those offenders to become involved in counseling, to become involved in positive behaviors, and reenter either general population for the rest of their lives, in some cases, or return to the community in better shape. An interesting statistic that not too many people know about, and it's a national statistic, that there are about 14,000 people currently in this country who have been in segregation for over 1 year. 14,000. That number changes every day, of course, but we'll use that as a rough number. In Minnesota, I'm going to ask you to maybe give a five-second speculation of what you think the number of people in segregation over a year in Minnesota is right today.
Six.
Seven. We have seven people over a year. The other statistic that goes with that is that four of those seven want to remain in segregation. For safety reasons, for mental health reasons. So we have constant attention to that population. Statistically, that's as much as I'm going to give you. But to your question, can we attribute recent assaults to policy? The conundrum that question presents to me is that there's an expectation that I would know or staff would know what the motivations are for offenders to commit assaults. That would mean I would have to be in the head of that offender when he commits the assault. I long ago gave up trying to, with 100% certainty, explain why people commit crimes. In these assault cases, we have seen some dynamics of personal vendettas. We have seen gang activity. We have seen street violence that has spilled over into the prisons that has led to some violence. And we have seen mental health, people with difficulties controlling their behaviors because of mental health issues. So I cannot, with any degree of certainty, tell you that our segregation initiative, which falls into a national initiative, has attributed anything to those assaults. I just can't do that this morning. As an officer in my former days, I was locked in cells with newly arrested individuals. My first three years of my career were in a county jail system. As a part of my job, I was locked in the cell with individuals that nobody knew anything about. I get safety. I know what it is all about. I am as concerned as you are and as the gentlemen in the back are, who daily walk into very high-stress prisons and do work that most citizens won't even think of doing. And this topic of assaults on staff is getting the highest attention from our administration that we can possibly give it. I will be saying these same words to representatives of those corrections officers tomorrow morning. We have shared those words numerous times, and it's a sad thing when a staff gets assaulted. I hope I have satisfied your question.
Representative Lomar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Thank you. I do appreciate your answer, and I appreciate all that you do. It sounds to me like you're working on it, but just looking for maybe ideas, other tools if segregation isn't, are there other ideas that you've come up with to de-incentivize folks from these behaviors? So thank you for working on that.
Thank you for your concern.
Commissioner Roy, I too have concerns about this issue. I have one of the facilities in my district. I've talked to a number of the staff, not only there but around the state, and they have a lot of concerns. This is something that does need to be addressed and addressed quickly. If there's anything that we can do to help you solve these issues, please let us know and we'll do what we can.
Mr. Chair, I do have some ideas that you can help with.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Roy, for coming down and talking a little bit about this issue. Obviously, we want all state employees, but certainly all of your corrections officers, to be as safe as possible inside the prison. To be really clear, in the last year's legislation, that ended up not being included in the final bill and not signed into law and not law, not becoming law. In that discussion around segregation and secure housing, the legislation that we were working on talked about accountability measures as far as who would have to be made aware of an incident where individuals stay in segregation past certain lengths of time, including finally the commissioner approving or signing off past a certain time. I believe it was 60 days in the legislation, just because I think accountability matters. And then the other part of that bill talked about data and getting reports back to the legislature about how many people have been in restricted housing or segregation for what types of infractions and for what lengths of time. For a myriad of reasons, that proposal didn't become law last year. And I'm just wondering if the commissioner, what your thoughts are on providing some reporting aspects back to the legislature. Because I think that would be helpful. I know several of us, even those that serve on this committee for years, were surprised with some of the numbers that came out in the Star Tribune series of stories that talked about individuals being in solitary confinement for 400, 500, 600, 700 days, and some individuals being in solitary confinement for 400, 500, 600, 700 days, and then immediately being released, not to general population, but literally out the front door of the prison after being in isolation for years. I, for one, don't believe that's a recipe for success. And so the request in the legislation was never in the language and how it was proposed and how it was discussed, was never to limit the commissioner or his staff's ability to use segregation as a tool for safety and a tool to manage behavior, but it was around the idea of helping to counter what I believe is the misnomer that people are thrown in the hole and kind of forgotten about. And that was the story we heard over and over and over. And so I think one way to do that is to ensure there's accountability that goes through the warden of the prison and to the commissioner, and that there's a report back to the legislature, so that if there are six individuals that are in isolation for a year, that we have, that we can speak to that and understand, you know, how that makes sense, why that makes sense, and to also put at ease the idea that the system is not being implemented surgically and very prescriptive. And so tomorrow I again will be bringing forward an amendment that looks for the reporting aspect of my bill from last year, in hoping that the numbers that I believe the department is already collecting would be provided to the legislature on an annual basis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Zerwas, if you're bringing that amendment for reporting, another piece that you should request in your report, and I was going to ask the commissioner if he could make it available to us. Under Minnesota Statute 609.2232, it is already the law that these inmates should be receiving consecutive sentences for assaults that they commit while they are in prison. I mean, it even includes misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor should be consecutive. And so it's my understanding that there is an issue on whether or not those cases are sentenced consecutively or concurrently. That law was passed in 1997. When I first got to the legislature, we had another bill to say it shall be consecutive, not concurrent. And they said that's already the law. And so we said we were going to put it in the statute to say we really meant it. And again, this legislature, I think, really means it. And so if we could get some information as well in that report about are these folks being sentenced consecutively or concurrently, that might enlighten us.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for your work and testimony. I guess I'll admit that I hadn't really focused on the health care contract issue. It just kind of hadn't been top of mind for me. And I thought a little bit alarming. Can you just describe if that money, and maybe I missed this in the early testimony, my apologies if so, but I mean, the DOC is required constitutionally to provide health care to offenders. I would argue it's also just a moral obligation. Once society's decided we're going to take somebody's freedom away for very good reasons, we then have an obligation to meet those needs. What happens if that funding does not come through this year?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Nan Larson, our health care director, will be sitting next to me, and she can speak to that.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nan Larson. I'm the health services director for the Department of Corrections. Representative Pinto, in response to your question, really good, we're going to have to find the funding elsewhere. We have a contract. We have to provide health care. We don't get to pick and choose who comes to us, so we can't take the sick ones and say bye, go back to the community. So we have to provide care to them, so we will have to find funding elsewhere. The commissioner mentioned what my budget entails. So my budget includes chemical dependency counseling, sex offender treatment, and we'd have to take probably funding out of those areas to fund the contract. So that means less CD treatment, less sex offender treatment.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. Thank you. So, I mean, so it sounds like you will be spending the $7.8 million. You will be spending $7.8 million more on the health care contract. That's budget, and that's just required. So I guess the issue is going to be then we'll be having you make the decision of what else gets cut rather than us making that decision, essentially, because that's what the position we'd be forcing you into by not having this funding. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, you are correct. We would be making that decision because we'd have to find the funding elsewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, as we're to get back to Representative Lohmer's question, as we're talking about preventing preventing violence and preventing assault against staff and the facilities, I mean, it seems to me would providing health care and providing treatment, you know, chemical dependency treatment, opioid treatment, would that potentially lead to preventing some of those assaults and acting out on, in your opinion?
Commissioner Wright.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we believe that all of our prison programming, our vocational work, our educational work, our treatment, all leads to a healthier prison environment. And everybody, I think, is in agreement that a healthy environment reduces stress, it reduces assaults. And if we can get to those core character traits that lead to violence with violence prevention programming, it's a better day for everybody. And if you saw the headlines tomorrow, Department of Corrections plans to release 8,000 people in 2019, I think that headline would get your attention. Guess what? That is what we're going to do. 8,000 of our folks in prison are going to be our neighbors. We have an absolute obligation to assure our citizens that we are doing the best we can in terms of treatment. We have an obligation to our staff to de-escalate violence, and all that types of programming accomplish that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, as we talk about what we can do to help you to prevent the violence that happens in the facilities, it's things like the opioid treatment and funding the health care contracts so that you don't have to take that money away from other programs that will help you in addressing the assaults in the facilities.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that funding is critical, and we have over the years asked for additional corrections officers. If you recall, I talk about it all the time, we did a staffing analysis, and we need over 100 officers to bring our complement up. And Mr. Chair, your offer to help, obviously it won't be this year, but some future commissioner will be asking the same question of this committee and the same request. I hope you're sincere in your hope to help us out, because we need officers.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. We will be releasing 8,000, but we'll also be admitting another 8,000. So the net is going to probably be zero. When I look at this healthcare contract and the added costs for offenders, and I don't know if it was 2 years ago that we allocated extra money for chemical dependency treatment and mental health treatment, 3 years ago. So really what we're doing is we're taking away that money that we actually allocated, because now you're going to have to utilize that money. So our efforts a few years ago to increase the funding for mental health treatment, which could be related to some of the assaults on officers, as well as chemical dependency, is now going to be kicked back down. So I think that when we fund these types of initiatives to try to address public safety, not only for when individuals get outside, but also while they're inside, they will actually create a real difficult situation, not just for you, but for everyone else relative to that, whether it's while the offender is locked up or why the offender is released. I mean, $7.8 million is more than we got in our whole budget for this committee. So I appreciate that the governor has put this forward, and I hope that as we move through the rest of this legislative session, that we'll actually be able to find you the money to assure that our offenders are getting the health care that is required in our Constitution. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I need to clarify something to make it crystal clear. This health care contract is the unfunded fiscal year 19. We should have been funded 18-19, but if you recall, we said that we were renegotiating the contract. Senate, House all agreed that I would come back and tell you about the new RFP and the response to the contract, which is actually $3 million less than last year's request. So the renegotiating of the contract is very attractive, and this is how we agreed to do business.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Very, very brief, so I just want to make sure I understand. So if we had funded, if you hadn't told us to sort of back off on year two, we presumably would have given you $10 million for year two, and now you've saved us $3 million, and you're just asking for the $7 million that's less than you would have asked for last year, Mr. Chair.
Sometimes the news is good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anyone else on the committee have a question? Okay, thank you, Commissioner Roy.
Appreciate the time. Thank you.
Commissioner Dolman. Unfortunately, that one took a lot longer time than I expected.
He always does that to me.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. For the record, my name is Mona Dolman, and I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. And I appreciate the opportunity, I will be brief, to just talk with you about this omnibus bill. I'd like to start by thanking you for the support of the work that we do at the Department of Public Safety. I respect and appreciate the difficult decisions that you are faced with in juggling the competing interests presented as you work to meet your targets in this supplemental budget. Public safety is one of government's core functions, and at the Department of Public Safety, it is our core mission. I want to thank you for including Representative Hillstrom's House File 3578, which is the Department of Public Safety's predatory offender registration policy proposal this year. The BCA runs Minnesota's predatory offender registration program and brings these changes forward as they prepare to upgrade the system, which was funded during the 2017 session, and I thank you for that as well. As you learned in a previous hearing on this bill, these changes update registration requirements, clarify notification requirements, bring us into compliance with international Megan's Law governing those who are required to register, who will be traveling overseas, and ensures that correction agents can share information for child protection studies. It's unfortunate that we did not have an opportunity to present the governor's supplemental budget proposals to this committee. Governor Dayton's proposals in his supplemental budget are our priorities, and I hope that you will reconsider and fully fund our proposal. The governor's proposal has two parts. The first is he recommends funding to increase the number of drug scientists at the BCA drug chemistry lab to reduce the turnaround time for drug evidence examination. Our goal is to get turnaround time down to 30 days. The second part is his proposal also increases the number of investigators to support tribal nations and DEA prescription diversion efforts across the state. The proposal supports a total of 9 full-time employees. Not fully funding these proposals will greatly reduce the impact of the criminal justice system and the court system. Full funding will speed the ability for individuals to enter into drug court or drug treatment, among other things. These proposals are part of the larger opioid action plan. They are strategic investments that support our communities, the ones that you represent and the ones that we serve. I believe that it's money well spent for the safety of Minnesotans. I just like to ask that you fully fund the proposals as are spelled out in the governor's supplemental budget. For fiscal year 19, this would be $1.432 million from the general fund, and for years 20 and 21, it would be an additional $1.154 million each year from the proposed opioid stewardship program, which is the penny a pill discussion. The last item of concern I'd like to comment on is that a piece of this bill includes funding from the Driver and Vehicle Services Special Revenue Account to implement the ignition interlock changes included in this bill.
We remain concerned with the multitude of bills moving through this legislative process that take funds from the driver and vehicle services accounts, and I just request that these overall impacts to the funds be taken into consideration. Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and members, and I look forward to working with you as we move through this legislative process.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee members? Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for all the work that you guys do over there. I do have a question about the opioid treatment and prevention programs that the governor is proposing on the penny a pill. Been doing some work with Representative Baker on the opioid epidemic, and if we do fund his bill separately, will that line up with the governor's proposal? Do you know where those items lie within Representative Baker's bill versus the governor's initiative?
Commissioner Dolman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to go back and look. I don't know the answer to that right now, but I can certainly get back to you.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, for the public's benefit, on the demand for narcotic investigations, heroin-related seizures are up more than 5,000%. And I just wanted to highlight that because that's a really, really large increase, and it makes sense that you would be asking for more funds, I think, when you look at that increase just from 2016 to 2017. That's incredible. Thank you.
Superintendent Evans.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we just would like to comment. We agree that it's incredible, and it's a number that we included in here because it illustrates the problem that the seizures are from our drug task forces across Minnesota. This isn't limited to one pocket of the state. This isn't limited to one community, and all the communities which you represent are experiencing these significant increases in drug and drug-related issues across Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Caroline Palmer. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the Public and Legal Affairs Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I'm just going to be brief. I'm really just here to thank the committee, thank the chair, thank the committee members, thank the bill authors and co-authors that are here on the committee for paying such close attention to sexual violence issues and related issues this session. And we really appreciate all of the policy and actions that are here in the proposals. So I just wanted to put that forward and again, give our thanks on behalf of all the sexual assault advocacy programs across the state. And I also wanted to additionally support the fact that the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force is included in here. As I discussed in front of the committee, sexual assault is certainly an issue that factors into that conversation. And also the attention being paid to vulnerable adults. That's another area where we see high numbers of sexual abuse. So, again, I just wanted to thank the committee for all of your efforts and support.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Thank you very much. Joel Carlson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I want to talk to you briefly about Article 2, Section 9, a provision that I dislike a little bit more this year than I liked last year. I want you to know that Section 9 of the bill will delay claims paid to your constituents. It will reduce what they're compensated when they've been injured by others, and it will actually increase litigation in Minnesota. I dislike this provision a little more this year because it ignores what's really going on in Minnesota courts. The Supreme Court tells us that civil case filings for injury cases, which are subject to this provision, are down an additional 12% between 2016 and 2017, and they are down 42% in the last 10 years. That, ironically, is the same period of time when we changed the judgment interest rate to the current 10%. Civil appeals are down since this law was changed almost 30%. 30%. Because we now have incentive to pay claims and not to just needlessly delay them and drag them out. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says Minnesota has one of the best civil litigation systems for corporate defendants in the country. And there were about 125 judgments, civil trial judgments, entered last year. That's it. That's what we're talking about. That is the entire case field that were tried to judgment. And let's remember what we're talking about here. These are judgments. These aren't frivolous matters. These are instances where the court or a trier of fact has determined that you have been harmed by someone else and that you're entitled to compensation. And let's remember what this interest is for. This is to compensate you for the loss of use of your money that someone has taken from you. And I like this bill a little bit less this year because the interest rates are up. Credit Karma, which makes us sign up to arbitrate with them if we use their service, tells us that a low-interest credit card right now, a low-interest credit card is 13.5%. That's the low one. This will not compensate you for the loss of use of your money. It will not provide prompt payment. There is no incentive to pay, and I'll get to this in a second, when you reduce judgment interest to 4%. And this will delay settlement of claims, and it will produce additional litigation and appeals. There is no question about it. This bill runs counter to everything, every purpose for why we have post-judgment interest. So what is this bill really about? This bill is about insurance companies being able to retain your premium dollars for as long as they can. And we see it every day. We all see flow, don't we? Insurance companies spend $7 billion a year, all paid for through our premiums, to get your premium dollar in the door. GEICO spent $4.5 million, more than the amount spent on judgment interest in Minnesota, for a 30-second spot during the Super Bowl. $4.5 million. They want to keep that money, and this I'll just close with this, Mr. Chair and members. The reason they want to keep your money longer was told to us by State Farm when they released their 2017 annual financial report. They had big catastrophic losses from storm damage in 2017. They lost $1.7 billion on their net premiums. The company's net worth during that same period of time increased by $10 billion. How did that happen? Because they're able to retain your premium dollars, invest it in the market and not get 2 or 4% like they want to pay, but get substantially beyond that. And that's what this bill is really all about. It's about them retaining your premiums and being able to invest it to make their net worth go up $10 billion at a time when their operating loss was $1.7 billion. This bill runs counter to what we want to have happen in our civil courts. I like Representative Zerwas every day even more, but I dislike this proposal even more this year because times have changed, and it's even more important now that we allow consumers to get compensated for the money that they've lost and been wrongly taken from them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm happy to answer questions.
Representative Zerwas?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this is a provision in the bill we talk about every year. And every year we have more and more states going the exact direction that this bill would propose to take Minnesota. And that is bring that interest rate more in line with accurate market conditions. And remember how we ferreted this bill out compared to the original version, in that we are just talking about interest after the judgment. And so the idea that this somehow is going to incent cases to be dragged out, that's just not the case. And so I think what's important with the bill is that it treats everybody equally. Remember that this change in the interest rate, the legislature already did for ourselves. We already did it for government. And so I think if it was good for the government, it's good for the rest of Minnesotans. We've passed the bill off the floor of the House before. I'm excited that the bill's added once again to the chairman's omnibus bill, and I look forward to the debate on the floor. I tried to save you time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Mr. Carlson. And members, we see this provision every year in this bill or in this committee. However, in all sorts of other committees, we set interest rates that people can charge that are in business. And so currently there is a proposal to allow storage companies to charge you 15% for late payments. So while we want to lower insurance rates, insurance companies and what they have to pay when they keep your money after they've already found to have harmed you, we continue to charge consumers more and more and more, and I just think it's the wrong direction. So you'll see an amendment tomorrow to take it out.
And Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Zerwas, I think we have it flipped a little bit.
You're right.
This bill does deal with pre-judgment interest only. It is the factor that allows for delay and stalling. And, you know, these people are not on your side. You're not in good hands. They use every loophole, exclusion, you know. And when you compare us with other states, we are not out of line. But this is not a savings rate. This is what you have to borrow while you're fighting through a case. And that's what you're trying to replace. That's why I think the 4% is so unfair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. You have always been gracious about hearing us out on this issue, and hopefully we can once again be successful and get this one out of there.
Well, you know.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Jerry Furcus. Mr. Furcus, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Welcome, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Furcus. I'm a correctional officer, Moose Lake Correctional Facility. Been there for 27 years. I also serve on the Council 5 Executive Board. First of all, I'd like to thank the opportunity to testify this morning on File 2856, Public Safety Bill. To start, I'd like to thank all the members on proving the state contract and Governor Dayton's signature. However, what I speak on is the funding for correctional officers, additional funding for correctional officers. As testified earlier, we have come several years and asked for more funding for correctional officers. We're short over 100 positions, and still we get no bail out of this. As a result, staff and inmates are more likely to be put in harm's way. We heard it with the recent reports of assaults. We are here to encourage the committee to sincerely look at ways to increase the number of the COs in these facilities, to maintain order of our prisons, ensure staff and inmates safety, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Jim Barbo.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Barbo. I've been a correctional officer at Moose Lake for 21 years. I'm currently holding the position of a canine handler, and I also serve as my local's union president. I, too, would like to thank the governor and this committee and the legislative group for passing our contract and funding the fundings that you've done so far. We are concerned about the lack of funding for the offender health care contract and also for the offender per diem increase. The department requested $7.8 million in 2018 and 19 and $6.5 million in 2020 and 21. of this funding will have a direct impact on how the work is done. This work directly affects me and my family and my community. Without the funding, permanent cuts are likely to occur to the department and their budget. We are already experiencing the effects not enough staff have on in our work areas. The cuts and the numbers of COs would be drastically reduced, in my belief, if we don't do the proper funding. As the representative here asked, the question is, are we going to have to pay for these? Yes, we will. It doesn't matter if you pass this funding or not today or tomorrow. The funding has to be done, and we will take these cuts somewhere, and that will probably be during programming and in the staffing numbers. And those numbers and those programming will have a dramatic effect on our security of these facilities. Without the funding of this health care contract, we as COs, we could be laid off, but we will be doing more overtime. The reason we do overtime is because we have a 24/7 operation. We don't go home at 5 o'clock. We're there 24/7. Without the providing this critical resource, the healthcare contract this year, it will only make the necessary cost of this to increase as the years go on. I've been an officer for 21 years. I've been fortunate through my department and through the union to go to numerous states for conferences, training, and Minnesota was held at a higher level, which I was always told when I came and started my career that we were up here. And it truly was. I thought maybe we were just blowing smoke at me. We were held up here. We are now coming down with the rest of the states. We are doing what they said don't do, because we did it. And we had issues. We had staffing concerns. We were not funding what we had to do properly to fund, which now becomes security of our facilities. We are doing that. They don't come in and ask us anymore, can we see what you're doing? We are following them. Let's become the leaders that we used to be. And that takes money and funding. I know you guys have been asked before to come do tours in our facilities. I'm not going to ask you to do a tour. I'm going to request you to come put on this uniform, walk with us in those halls for an eight-hour, for an eight-hour day, maybe 2 days, and see what you're not doing the funding, how it affects us. It not only affects us, our family, our community. Thank you. I'll answer any questions you have.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming to testify, both of you. I don't really have a question, but I have a comment for you and for the committee. Thank you for your work. And some of us have toured. And I'm reminded of a variety of institutions. If you don't have the staff, if you don't have the opportunity to provide the programming, the health care, mental health services, then there are going to be problems. Mental and physical health go with all sorts of the vocational programming. If people are kept busy in constructive ways, where they have some hope and can see a future for themselves, then your job is more reasonable. It's a tough position to be in, and I'm just disappointed that we are not providing the resources that corrections and public safety need in order to do their job and to keep us safe. I want to say thank you.
I appreciate it. I don't disagree with you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too want to thank Mr. Barbo and Mr. Furcus for their work. I think it was the commissioner who said before that that it's work that so many of us would not even consider at all. And as I'm a prosecutor, and I can say I would not want to be interacting daily with many of the folks that I'm sending to them that you all are dealing with and on the front lines. And I guess I just want to emphasize in your comments made me think about this, that it's pretty easy for us to pass laws, rules, policies, whatever it is, but it's the people on the front lines implementing them who have to actually do that work. And what I'm hearing from you is saying, look, if we get squeezed in one area in healthcare,
and we bring the money from someplace else, then that's hurting programming that is going to be making us less safe. And if our big concern is assaults on correctional officers and others, you're telling us the way to prevent those is by making sure that we have a robust and fully funded system, including some more correctional officers. So I just want to lift up what you're saying and support it, and thank you very much for the work you do both in Moose Lake and then certainly here as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Max Hall. And members, we do have two more testifiers that had signed up after the agenda was presented.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a uniform, but I'll give this a go anyway. My name is Max Hall. I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. Council 5 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees represents approximately 43,000 men and women who work for the state and local units of government. As you've heard from two correctional officers of our membership, we represent more than 2,000 correctional officers in this state, as well as about 200 guardians ad litem. So my testimony will be focused on the guardian ad litem program. House File 2856, as obviously you're aware, Mr. Chairman, includes supplemental funding for the guardian ad litem program in terms of funding 45 additional FTEs. So I want to sincerely thank you, Mr. Chairman, for putting that funding in, as well as Representative Hillstrom's work in supporting that program. We really appreciate both of you and other members. We are really proud to represent guardians ad litem and strongly support them in their work to protect children and ensure they're placed in supportive and safe households. As a result of the Office of Legislative Auditor's report, which this committee has heard, the need for additional staffing is critically warranted. And so, again, their work needs to be supported, though, with ongoing funding. So that's really critical. I had the opportunity to shadow several of our members, guardians ad litem, at the Stearns County Courthouse. They do extraordinary work in order to prepare reports and documentation for the court in order for judges to make proper decisions for child placement. It's a very critical component of our judicial system. So making sure that every child has that representation is absolutely necessary, and this funding at least gets us to a good standard to make that a reality. So, Mr. Chair, you including this funding clearly shows that you prioritize the protection of children and the notion that every child ought to have representation in the court system. And so I'll conclude with saying thank you again. Thank you. I'm open for questions if there are any.
Okay. Court. Fulton. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
I'm Court Halton. I represent the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. This will be about 30 seconds, Mr. Chairman. I'm here to put on a record the fact that we believe there's an unintended consequence in Article 3, Section 16, which is on page 33. That's Representative Grassl's bill on disarming police officers. And I'm just here today to say that we're going to come forward with language, provided that Representative Grassl agrees to it, and I'm just here in the interest of transparency to put that on your radar.
Thank you. Lori Kursak. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Kusick. I'm the Guardian Ad Litem Program Manager in Hennepin County. I would like to start by thanking the group for having us here on behalf of the State Guardian Ad Litem Program and myself. As the program manager in Hennepin County, we are dealing with 25% approximately of the child protection cases in the state of Minnesota. And I wanted to come here and talk a little bit about the situation in Hennepin County and why we are appreciative and looking for support for our program in order to be able to have more guardians doing the work. Currently, we have 304 unassigned guardian cases in Hennepin County, which translates to about 652 children who are not having a guardian or advocacy on their behalf in Hennepin County. This is the third year in a row that we have been unable to assign guardians to our cases, even though they're federally and state mandated to be on there. A Hennepin County guardian is currently carrying 30 to 35 cases, which translates to about 60 to 80 children per case, some more. Some are carrying 90, 100 children on their caseload. And the cases are coming in at such an alarming rate that in a two-day period, we had 16 cases, brand new cases come in 2 days, which is exactly half of a full-time equivalent of a position. And so you can understand that during the course of this, we're going farther and farther behind, and the numbers never did plateau. They just keep coming in. So it's been extremely difficult. Some of the things that we have done, steps taken, I have converted several administrative positions to guardian positions to be able to try and cover those. I have also moved guardians from our family court over to juvenile court. So I have 8 family court guardians. Two-thirds of their caseload now are juvenile child protection cases. This, of course, has shorted our family court guardians with the information, or shorted our family court judicial officers with the information that these guardian ad litem can provide to those judges regarding specific children and recommendations. Mandatory family court cases always deal with an issue of abuse and neglect and the safety of the children. So we really are shorting the juvenile court or the family court judges with guardians available when we're talking about difficult safety issues also occurring in family court. We also, I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of the guardian. The guardian ad litem is oftentimes the only constant person who works with that child throughout the lifetime of that court case. Guardians develop a supportive and trusting relationship with these children. As we know, children who are forced to deal with trauma often have significant difficulties over the course of their lifetime. Studies show that a trusted person advocating for that child's best interests and building a strong personal relationship is the most significant factor determining whether that child suffers the negative effects of trauma or develops a positive resilience in dealing with this trauma. Protecting and advocating for the interests of Minnesota's most vulnerable children should be of the utmost importance to all of us striving to keep our children safe. An example of the outstanding unassigned cases that we have, I just want to go through a couple of them. One of them, we have a case involving 8 children. The father is smoking meth in the bedroom of the house while the children are in the living room. The father is using and selling meth, and he is in charge of the 4 youngest children while the mother is at work. The home was raided, the dad was arrested, and the mom had suspected he was using, but she had nobody else to watch her children and had to rely on him. Another case, the mother in this case was deceased. The child was residing with different relatives and friends when a domestic incident occurred between a 16-year-old and the father. The child was assaulted by the father, hit 30 times or more with a hard object. Currently, the 16-year-old is 4 months pregnant, and the father is facing criminal charges. Those are just 2 of the pages and pages and pages I now have of cases that we do not have guardians assigned to. I also want to talk about in Hennepin County, 80% of our children in Hennepin County are children of color. That is a very high rate, and these children statewide are being denied the advocacy that they deserve and should have in Hennepin County. These children are falling through the cracks, and this is the third year that this is happening. They deserve our protection. We need your support, and I'm hoping that you are able to provide us with the funding that we need to continue this work. So I thank you very much for your time. I can answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Great. I want to thank you for
thank
coming
you so
here.
Much.
One comment I do want to make, brought up about the from the guards talking about putting on a uniform and seeing what's like in their world. I know Representative Considine and myself, we did wear a uniform every day. We know we understand what you go through and what your family goes through. We want to do everything we can to help you, but sometimes there's only given so many dollars to work with. But I do understand, and I want to make sure that you guys are safe. And with that, we will be adjourned.